from New York, this is Democracy Now!
I believe the threat to our democracy is so grave that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills. Debate them. Vote. Let the majority prevail. And if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster for this.
In a major speech in Atlanta, President Biden's endorsed changing the filibuster rules to help Senate Democrats pass major voting rights legislation. We'll speak to two leaders in the voting rights movement, one who boycotted Biden's address and one who attended. Then we go to the Bronx, where 17 people, including 8 children, have died in a massive fire in an apartment building. The city's blaming the fire on a space heater. But housing advocates say the real issue is the lack of safe, affordable public housing.
As an organizer in the Southwest Bronx for the last 8 years and working with thousands of tenants over countless buildings who have all experienced these issues, as well as not having heat or getting repairs, being harassed, living without gas, I have to say that I'm really shocked and astonished that the city leadership would blame tenants.
And we'll look at a fight in New Jersey to stop a new gas-fired power plant in Newark.
A year after passing the strongest environmental justice law in the country, Governor Murphy's betraying our communities that he swore to protect black and brown people. He's trying to put a fourth fossil fuel power plant in our neighborhood. Despite trying to fight climate change and environmental racism, Governor Murphy is breaking his promises to our communities.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's publicly endorsed changing Senate rules to prevent Republicans from using the filibuster to block voting rights legislation. Biden spoke Tuesday in Atlanta, Georgia.
To protect our democracy, I support changing the Senate rules, whichever way they need to be changed, to prevent a minority of senators from blocking action on voting rights. When it comes to protecting majority rule in America, the majority should rule in the United States Senate.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is expected to introduce proposals to change the filibuster rules as early as today in an effort to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. But it remains unclear if Democrats will have enough votes due to possible opposition from Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. A number of voting rights groups in Georgia boycotted Biden's speech, saying they needed concrete action, not a, quote, photo op. We'll speak to two prominent voting rights leaders after headlines, one who attended Biden's speech and one who refused. As the record-breaking Omicron-fueled COVID surge continues, the acting commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, Janet Woodcock, told lawmakers most people will get COVID-19. Woodcock said the focus should be on making sure hospitals and other essential services can still function. U.S. daily cases are now averaging over 760,000 with record hospitalizations. Here in New York City, students staged walkouts Tuesday to protest COVID protocols and learning conditions. The protest included hundreds of students from New York's largest high school, Brooklyn Tech. Meanwhile, in Oakland, California, students have petitioned the school district to go to remote learning and implement better safety protocols, threatening to boycott in-person classes. In Chicago, organizers are calling on federal investigators to look into Mayor Lori Lightfoot's use of pandemic relief funds, accusing her of using the money to pay down city debt instead of helping those in need, including Chicago's public schools. The Red Cross has declared a national blood crisis as the U.S. sees its worst blood shortage in over a decade. Blood donations have decreased 10% since the start of the pandemic in March 2020. The organization urged those who can to donate blood and platelets, as the Red Cross warns it has, quote, less than a one-day supply of critical blood types. Top White House pandemic advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci confronted Senator Rand Paul during a Senate hearing Tuesday, accusing Paul of endangering his life with repeated lies.
A person was arrested who was on their way from Sacramento to Washington, D.C. at a speed stop in Iowa. And the police asked him where he was going, and he was going to Washington, D.C. to kill Dr. Fauci. And they found in his car an AR-15 and multiple magazines of ammunition because he thinks that maybe I'm killing people. So I ask myself, why would Senator want to do this? So go to Rand Paul website and you see fire Dr. Fauci with a little box that says contribute here. You can do $5, $10, $20, $100. So you are making a catastrophic epidemic for your political gain.
In international news, aid workers in Ethiopia say at least 17 people, including women and children, were killed when a drone bombed a flour mill in the Tigray region Monday. A separate attack killing two people was also reported. The attacks came on the same day President Biden spoke by phone with the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The White House says Biden raised concerns about civilian casualties in Ethiopia's 14-month conflict in Tigray that's left thousands of people dead and millions displaced. The U.S. Coast Guard said it rescued 176 Haitian nationals from a precarious boat headed towards the Florida coastline Monday. This comes as the United States continues its mass deportations of Haitians amidst a mounting security and political crisis there. 7 deportation flights were reported yesterday alone. Today marks 12 years since the devastating 2010 earthquake in Haiti, which killed an estimated 300,000 people. The Justice Department announced it's forming a new unit to combat the growing threat of domestic terrorism. Assistant Attorney General Matthew Olson told the Senate committee Tuesday the number of FBI domestic terror investigations has more than doubled since March 2020.
We've seen a growing threat from those who are motivated by racial animus, as well as those who ascribe to extremist anti-government and anti-authority ideologies.
While Democrats opened the hearing with a video about the January 6th insurrection, Republicans worked to center questioning around leftist protest movements. Pressed by Senator Chuck Grassley, the FBI's Jill Sanborn said the agency has opened over 800 cases related to the 2020 wave of Black Lives Matter protests. Protesters have been taken to the streets of Fayetteville, North Carolina, following the deadly shooting of Jason Walker, a Black father, in front of his own home by an off-duty sheriff's deputy Saturday. Officer Jeffrey Hash, who's white, says he shot the 37-year-old Walker after he jumped on his car. Attorney Ben Crump, who's representing Walker's family, says the killing appears to be another case of shoot first, ask later. The city council has asked the U.S. Justice Department to get involved in the investigation. A hunger strike is underway at the Rikers Island Jail in New York City. About 200 people began the strike to protest deplorable conditions inside, citing the rapid spread of COVID, inadequate heating, and a growing level of violence at the city-run jail. Many of the hunger strikers say they haven't been allowed outside in weeks. The U.S. Navy has finally agreed to an order from state officials in Hawaii to drain a massive underground storage facility near the Pearl Harbor Navy base following a large leak. State health officials recently found petroleum levels 350 times the safe limit in a water system that serves over 90,000 families near Pearl Harbor. Navy leaders were grilled about the water contamination during a congressional hearing Tuesday. Military families had demanded action after getting sick from drinking the water, with some having to be hospitalized. Clyde Bellecourt, co-founder of the American Indian Movement, has died at the age of 85. In 1972, AIM organized a major march to Washington, D.C., called the Trail of Broken Treaties. Bellecourt was a prominent figure in the occupation of Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1973. In 2013, we spoke with Bellecourt about the campaign to force the Washington football team to change its racist name.
We're putting pressure on the whole world about these racist slurs and this continued cultural genocidal policies of this government. Let's not forget, there's over 2,000 high schools, colleges, and universities throughout America have changed. They said they would never change their name, just like Dan Snyder, but they have changed. Every single one of them have changed, and so will happen to this Washington team.
In 2020, the Washington NFL team finally retired its old name. You can see our full interview with Clyde Bellecourt at democracynow.org. His Ojibwe name was Nigan Wewidan, meaning thunder before the storm. In Buffalo, New York, Starbucks workers have successfully unionized a second U.S. location of the coffee chain. On Monday, the National Labor Relations Board certified the victory from a December election, ruling in favor of the union, which challenged a number of votes from people that it said do not work at the shop. Meanwhile, a Starbucks in Eugene, Oregon, has become the first Oregon location to petition for unionization. In more labor news, Amazon workers at the Bessemer, Alabama warehouse will vote again starting next month on what would be the company's first U.S.-based union. Ballots will be counted on March 28th. The new vote comes after the National Labor Relations Board found Amazon interfered with the first election last year and intimidated workers. In Maine, labor advocates are blasting Democratic Governor Janet Mills after she vetoed a bill that would have allowed farm workers to unionize. In Florida, Democrat Sheila Cherfilus McCormick has won a special election to replace Congressmember Alcee Hastings, who died last year of pancreatic cancer. Her win brings the House to a 222-212 Democratic majority. Meanwhile, Californians in the 22nd congressional district will vote in a special primary in April to select a replacement for Republican Congressmember Devin Nunes, who resigned earlier this month to become CEO of the Trump Media and Technology Group. And the Treasury Department started circulating quarters featuring the celebrated author Maya Angelou. She died 2014. She's the first Black woman to be featured on the 25-cent coin. Hers is the first in a series of special edition quarters featuring notable American women throughout history. Others include physicist and astronaut Sally Ride, Chinese-American Hollywood star Anime Wong, and indigenous activist Wilma Mankiller, the first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
In a major speech in Atlanta, Georgia, President Biden's endorsed changing the filibuster rules to prevent Republicans from using the filibuster to block voting rights legislation. Biden spoke in Atlanta.
I believe that the threat to our democracy is so grave that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills. Debate them. Vote. Let the majority prevail. And if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster for this.
Biden spoke in Atlanta after he and Vice President Kamala Harris laid a wreath at Martin Luther King Jr.'s crypt and visited the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church, where MLK was pastor. During his speech, Biden referenced King's struggle to secure voting rights.
Will you stand against voter suppression? Yes or no? That's the question they'll answer. Will you stand against election subversion? Yes or no? Will you stand for democracy? Yes or no? And here's one thing every senator, every American should remember. History has never been kind to those who've sided with voter suppression over voters' rights. And it'll be even be less kind for those who side with election subversion. So I ask every elected official in America, how do you want to be remembered? At consequential moments in history, they present a choice. Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? This is the moment to decide, to defend our elections, to defend our democracy.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is expected to introduce proposals to change the filibuster rules as early as today in an effort to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the Freedom to Vote Act. But it remains unclear if Democrats have enough votes due to possible opposition from Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Democratic lawmakers drafted the two bills in part because 19 states, including Georgia, passed new laws to restrict voting access in the way wake of the 2020 election. A number of voting rights groups in Georgia, including the group Black Voters Matter, boycotted Biden's speech, saying they needed concrete action, not a photo app. Not a photo op. Also not there was Stacey Abrams, who's running for governor and is the leading voting rights advocate. We're joined now by Cliff Albright, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter. Also joining us is Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, former president of the NAACP. He traveled to Atlanta to hear Biden's address. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. On this issue, you were on two sides, but you're together on the issue of voting rights. Ben, let's begin with you. Why did you attend the address? Talk about what you think should come out of it.
All right, you know, to check in with my good friend and former cellmate, Cliff Albright. It was important to me to be there to make sure that Biden actually followed through on our demand that he call on the Senate, and to quite celebrate when he did. You know, we had been to jail, hundreds of us. We had called the White House, hundreds of thousands of us. We had written the White House, millions of us signing petitions. And as one of the leaders of that movement, for me, it was a moment to really celebrate all the activists and celebrate the president joining us in this push. At the same time, I deeply respect Cliff and his work and Black Voters Matter and totally understood why they were not there. What's important is that we remain on the battlefield together, pushing forward together. And we're all very clear. In the final analysis, the only thing that will matter is getting these laws passed and passed now.
And Cliff Albright, of co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter, why did you decide to stay away? And also the importance from your perspective of President Biden making this speech?
Yeah, good morning to you all. And yeah, I just want to reiterate what my good friend Ben said. As a matter of fact, we met and broke bread and had some laughs before the speech. And so we weren't putting out a call for other groups, for national groups to not attend. We just made a decision as Georgia-based organizations that we probably were strong. We needed to make a strong statement that we didn't think that he should even be in Georgia giving a speech. We would have preferred that he was in D.C. giving a speech. We actually preferred that he was at the Senate giving a speech directly to the senators so that they could then do what they could actually, as Amy said, that they're planning on doing, reintroducing some of this legislation and reforms to the filibuster today. Guess what? That could have actually started yesterday, but they weren't in D.C. And so so that was really what our position was. It's not any spite for Joe Biden. You know, we like Joe, right? We believe that he wants to do right. In fact, as we said, at many of the demonstrations that Ben and I were at, getting arrested at over the summer and fall, what we repeatedly say is we're not doing this because we don't expect anything out of Joe Biden or because we think ill of him. It's because we expect more out of him. We know that he's got the skills to get more done after 40 years of being in the Senate, that he can whip two votes. So that's what our position was about. But there's absolutely no daylight between us and any of the organizations that attended. In fact, shortly later on today, we'll be doing a joint presser and debrief with some of the organizations, including Ben and People for the American Way and some of the other organizations that we have been in these streets for months, asking the president to do exactly what he wound up doing yesterday. That speech was a speech that was written by movement. It was written by movement power because it's movement power that brought Joe Biden from where he was months ago, saying that modifying or ending the filibuster would be chaos, to the speech we saw yesterday, which was a strong call for the filibuster to be modified for voting rights.
And Ben, I wanted to ask you, the president focused largely on the obstructionism of Republicans on this legislation, but you're a veteran of these civil rights battles. You know that it's not just Republican-controlled states that hold back voter participation. Democratic states like New York and Delaware have very limited provisions for voter participation. In Illinois right now, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund is challenging the redistricting proposal of a blue state because it doesn't provide sufficient representation for the Latino population of Chicago. So isn't really voter suppression sometimes a bipartisan issue of incumbents?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I spent a good part of my childhood in Monterey County, California, which you'll recall was included in Section 5 because of its discrimination against Chicanos. And, you know, the reality is that there are still games played. In Delaware, when we were expanding voting rights in Maryland, we went to Democrats in Delaware. I was leading the NAACP, and we asked them to do early voting like we were doing in Maryland and same-day registration. And they said only for the general, not for the primary. And it was pretty obvious to us at the NAACP at the time that they didn't want more black folks flooding into any primary and upsetting the balance of power in their own party. And so, sure, games are played. One of the most important things of the Freedom to Vote Act is the ways in which it'll force transparency and all the dark money that floods in. You know, you look at my state, Maryland, it looks like Larry Hogan will be getting into this Senate race. He certainly seems to be doing everything he can. And right now it looks like he would likely beat our sitting Senator Chris Van Hollen. Well, he gets into this race, it'll become the most expensive Senate race in the country. You'll see dark money flood in. As a Marylander, I'm eager to see this law pass so that when the Koch brothers are buying ads for Larry Hogan, we know.
Cliff Albright, talk about the voter suppression laws passed in Georgia at this point. You're talking about ballot boxes being dramatically reduced for the next election, among other things, and then talk about it nationally.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Amy. Let me say something real quick on the previous question. Some of the members of this Georgia coalition are the Galileo, the Latino organization, Jerry Gonzalez, Asian Americans Advancing Justice. They've been pushing for more provisions in the voting rights legislation related to language justice, right? And so that's a very issue. I'm glad that you raised that. I just wanted to add that in there on behalf of our Georgia partners. In regards to the Georgia bill, yes, I mean, some of the most dangerous provisions, everybody knows about the food and water restrictions. The vice president spoke about that, and I don't think her speech is getting enough attention. You know, obviously the president was the headliner talking about the filibuster, but
well,
you know,
Cliff,
the vice president
why don't
talked
we do,
about...
Why don't we go to... Vice President Kamala Harris, of course, the first African-American vice president in the United States. You're right. A lot of the B-roll that you see is her walking with the president. And you even see her going to the podium. But as soon as the words come out, they're President Biden's. This is Kamala Harris speaking about voting rights in Atlanta.
My fellow Americans, do not succumb to those who would dismiss this assault on voting rights as an unfounded threat, who would wave this off as a partisan game. The assault on our freedom to vote will be felt by every American in every community, in every political party. And if we stand idly by, our entire nation will pay the price for generations to come.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris. And by the way, they were speaking at the Morehouse Clark Atlanta University complex, two historically black colleges, right near the residence hall of Martin Luther King Jr., after having just come from his and Coretta Scott's grave, their crypt, with the family of Dr. King, who I think to the end was deciding Martin Luther King III whether to be a part of this. But Cliff, keep going.
Yeah, in terms of the Georgia bill, in addition to the food and water, you know, one of the most dangerous provisions, and this is something that we're seeing in several of these bills in several states, are the attacks on election administration, on election subversion, the attacks on election officials, both at the state level as well as at the local level. Of course, in Arizona, they took away some powers from the Arizona Secretary of State. In Georgia, what the bill allows them to do is allows the Republican legislature to actually take over some local boards of elections. And we've already seen them replacing board members in some counties within the state already. And so it's already having an impact. And that's one of the most dangerous pieces, because what it means is, regardless of what we do to organize and mobilize folks, and regardless of what the vote counts are, literally, if this law was in place in November of 2020, when Donald Trump was calling up the Secretary of State of Georgia, asking him to go out and find 11,700 votes, this bill would have made it easier for that Republican Secretary of State to do that, right? He could have either found some votes, or more importantly, he could have gotten rid of some votes in just one county, Fulton County. That would have been able to tip the scales of the election. He couldn't do that. Be clear, the Georgia Secretary of State is no profile in courage. He would have done it if he had the power to do it. He didn't then, but they do now because of this bill. That's the most dangerous provision. And then, of course, it gets into other things like, you know, the days of early voting and attacks on vote by mail. In fact, they're trying to go even further. And this is what we got to keep in mind. Even now, states are coming back into session. Georgia just started its new session, and they're trying to go further by trying to get rid of drop boxes in the state. And so the attack has not ended. That's why we need this legislation this week.
And now, Cliff, some critics have said that President Biden is acting too late and now at this point, that he should have acted sooner. But isn't the history of these battles President Johnson had to be dragged, basically kicking and screaming, to approve the Voting Rights Act. It wasn't, and at that time he had a huge majority in Congress for the Democratic Party. Of course, there were a lot of Dixiecrats in the Democratic Party at that time that made it more difficult for him. But usually, when presidents decide to take a strong stand, it's after enormous pressure has been put upon them by mass movements, isn't it?
Look, at the end of the day, Frederick Douglass told us a long time ago, power can seize nothing without a demand. And so we knew that it was going to take some. Actually, we didn't think it was going to take this much pressure. We thought that after January 6th last year, that one of the first things President Biden would have done when he came in would have been to deal with voting rights. We know, obviously, we were in the midst of COVID at that time, but still, we thought that voting rights was fresh and needed to be dealt with immediately. But we knew that it was going to take some pushback and some organizing to make it happen. We didn't think it was going to take more than a year, you know. But again, you know, Ben and I and other organizations, hundreds of organizations, have been pushing for this in order to have power do what it should be doing for the entire year. So we're not naive. We knew that it was going to take that. We knew that in 65 it took exactly that, and we were prepared to do our part. But, you know, there was a graphic that was put up on another program yesterday where it showed the number of speeches the president gave on COVID, the number he gave on infrastructure, and a number on voting rights. Before yesterday, the last speech he gave on voting rights was in July. And so 6 months went by with no action, at least no public or noticeable action on the issue of voting rights. And it was put behind other issues on the list of the agenda, which, again, that's what we were arguing for, to move it up in terms of prioritization. So, yes, it's late, but, you know, I think Dr. King said something like, you know, it's always a good time. It's always the right time to do right. Right now is the right time to do right. If he can follow up the speech yesterday with actions pressuring Manchin and Sinema, helping Senator Schumer to do so. And it's not just the president. We need other senators that support voting rights to also encourage their colleagues, right? And that's been happening more over the past 2 weeks as more Democratic senators who had been on the fence about filibuster reform have started to come out. Maggie Hassan, Angus King, right? Kane in Virginia. That's what we need to have happen over these next few days as Senator Schumer reintroduces this legislation. Everybody's got a role to play, but we're definitely glad that the president has now leaned in a little bit more in regards to filibuster reform.
So let's hear what President Joe Biden said about filibuster reform when it comes to voting rights.
Filibuster is not used by Republicans to bring the Senate together, but to pull it further apart. Filibuster is weaponized and abused. While the state legislative assaults on voting rights is simple, all you need in your House and Senate is a pure majority. In the United States Senate, it takes a supermajority, 60 votes, even to get a vote, instead of 50 to protect the right to vote. State legislators can pass anti-voting laws with simple majorities. If they can do that, then the United States Senate should be able to protect voting rights by a simple majority. Today, I'm making it clear, to protect our democracy, I support changing the Senate rules, whichever way they need to be changed, to prevent a minority of senators from blocking action on voting rights. When it comes to protecting majority rule in America, the majority should rule in the United States Senate. I make this announcement with careful deliberation, recognizing the fundamental right to vote is a right from which all other rights flow.
So that is President Biden yesterday. Ben Jealous, can you explain? The argument is, if you carve out for voting rights, then what, if the Republicans gain power, they'll do this. But if they gain power, they will do it anyway. In 2017, they did a carve out for Supreme Court justices. They don't need 60 votes. Just recently, you had the carve out for the debt limit. Can you explain how this would work?
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, there's been carve-outs like 160 times in U.S. history. And you're absolutely right. The Republicans have no problem using their power, breaking promises. They've done it again and again. So for us to not use power because we fear them using power is ridiculous. And if only we protect voting rights for one more election, that's critical. Now, the way that this would work, actually, there's many options, Amy. One of the things, you know, when you listen to folks, some folks say, well, I'm not for getting rid of the filibuster, but I am okay with rules reform. It was so important that Amy Klobuchar was there yesterday, who's head of the Rules Committee, because everybody knows there are many ways to do this. You simply could retain the filibuster, but lower the threshold, you know, based with each round of debate for what it takes to get a vote to the floor until you get to a simple majority. The bottom line is that right now, 40 senators can stop 100 senators from having a vote. And that is absolutely unheard of anywhere else in our democracy. It was not intended by the founders to occur in our Senate. It has brought Washington to a standstill, and it's got to change.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, Cliff Albright, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter, both today in Atlanta, Georgia, after the speeches of President and Vice President Biden and Harris. Next, we go to the Bronx, where 17 people, the majority children, have died in a massive fire, all eight children, at an apartment building. Who's to blame? Stay with us.
Rich people living in paradise. Poor people under the bridge at night. Oh, yeah. Most people know what it takes to survive. Well, my people know how to do it and thrive. Oh, yeah. My people, we've been left behind because my people, devil's knocking on your door. My people, sent so many here to death. My people, and we still here, and one day we gonna all be in the same. Rich people still living high and dry.
My People by Chawa. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez here in New York. At a vigil Tuesday night, people mourn the 17 victims of a high-rise apartment building in the Bronx, the city's deadliest fire in decades. Officials have now released the names of the 17 people who died in Sunday's deadly fire in the 19-story apartment building in the Bronx. They range in age from 2 to 50 years old. Some came from the same families. All of them died from smoke inhalation. Many were immigrants from West Africa and part of the local Muslim community. A nearby mosque and the Gambian Youth Organization are gathering support for families of the dead and the survivors. Investigators say Sunday's fire began when an electric space heater malfunctioned. The victims suffered from severe smoke inhalation after a pair of open doors allowed smoke to spread throughout the building. The building acted as a kind of chimney. City records show tenants of the Twin Parks Tower had complained about a lack of heat in the building and doors that didn't close automatically as required by law. The building did not have fire escapes or sprinklers, and many people were trapped in upper floors where self-closing doors were supposed to have blocked toxic smoke and flames from spreading. The new New York City mayor, Eric Adams, spoke outside the Bronx building Monday.
And if we take one message from this that Commissioner Nigro has mentioned several times, close the door. Close the door. That was embedded in my head as a child watching the commercials over and over again. We're going to double down on that message. My conversation with the chancellor this morning, we're going to send out communications to all of our schools and state that we want our children to receive the same level of reinforcement. Muscle memory is everything. And if we can drill that in, we can save lives by closing the doors, not only in this city, but across the entire globe. This painful moment can turn into a purposeful moment as we send the right message of something simple as closing the door.
Housing activists say the real responsibility for saving lives lies with city agencies like Housing Preservation and Development, or HPD, that are charged with enforcing building safety codes. Democracy Now! Spoke with the director of CASA, that's Community Action for Safe Apartments, Pablo Estupnian, on Tuesday.
As an organizer in the Southwest Bronx for the last 8 years and working with thousands of tenants over countless buildings who have all experienced these issues, as well as not having heat or getting repairs, being harassed, living without gas, I have to say that I'm really shocked and astonished that the city leadership would blame tenants, that they would say that fire doors, closing the doors is enough and that people shouldn't have had space heaters. That kind of response neglects any responsibility or accountability on city agencies like HPD, or the Department of Buildings, DOB, and their lack of code enforcement. So, our experience is that tenants will go in buildings living with these conditions or lack of heat for months, for years on end, and there's never any meaningful action taken by the city. The only time that the times that we are successful in getting landlords to change the conditions of their buildings often comes through legal action, through tenants organizing together and filing joint group housing park cases in housing court to get repairs. And even after a judge's order, we have seen buildings where HPD will still refuse to come in and make repairs or hold the landlord accountable.
That's CASA Director Pablo Estupinian. The building where Sunday's fire took place is owned by an investment group whose co-founder, Rick Roper, served on Mayor Eric Adams' transition team as a housing advisor. For more, we're joined by reporter Claudia Irizarry-Ponte, who covers the Bronx for the New York-based outlet The City and has been closely following that story. Her latest article's headline, Self-Closing Door Law Failed to Save Bronx Fire Victims and Deadly Bronx Blaze Prompts Scrutiny of Open Door That Spread Smoke. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And by the way, congratulations on the announcement that you've just received the Ida B. Wells Award honoring exceptional coverage of communities of color from the Newswomen's Club of New York. And I think that goes directly to your superb reporting on this issue. We hear the mayor and the governor, we hear them talking about the space heater. Well, why was it so cold that space heaters were needed? And tenants leaving open doors, they're supposed to be automatically closing. Is that not right, Claudia? Talk about what you found.
That's right, Amy and Juan. Good morning, and thank you for having me. So there are two things that may have contributed to the fire. Of course, there's the issue of the malfunctioning space heater and the fact that the door of the apartment where the fire originated on the third and second floor duplex apartment did not close properly, allowing for the smoke to spread more quickly. But of course, that begs the question of why these tenants were using a space heater in the first place and why the building was not warm enough. Certainly from the tenants that I have spoken with, I've been on the site every day since Sunday. That is a top question on these tenants' minds. You know, I have heard from tenants who say that I have heard from multiple tenants who say that they also use space heaters because they did not find that their apartments were warm enough, that they claim that their windows were not insulated. And on very cold days, they would actually get frost on the interior part of their windows. Of course, this is not an old building by New York City infrastructure standards. It's about 50 years old. It was built in the 1970s, in fact, as a model of affordable housing in the city, receiving federal and state funds to subsidize housing. But certainly in a lot of these buildings, you know, tenants are not able to control the temperature in their own apartments. They don't have thermostats. That is all up to the building management. And for a lot of these tenants, many of whom are seniors, children, multi-generational families living within the same household, you know, they had to resort to using ovens to stay warm. They had to resort to using space heaters to stay warm. And unfortunately, you know, when these tools malfunction, you get fires like the one we saw on Sunday. So a lot of the tenants that I have spoken to, in fact, all of them, you know, are really asking for accountability, not just from the state and city agencies, but first and foremost from their landlord and the building owners.
And Claudia, this whole issue of obviously this building did not have fire escapes or sprinklers, because supposedly these more modern, relatively, as you say, modern buildings are supposed to be to some extent fireproof and have at least double staircases for exiting in case fires occur. And what's your sense? Because most of the people died not of smoke inhalation. Could you talk about what caused the deaths?
So Fire Commissioner Daniel Nigro said that, unfortunately, most of the victims did die from smoke inhalation. We don't know much detail about where exactly the victims were found. All we do know is that in terms of the people who are in fact still injured, and to use Commissioner Nigro's own words, fighting for their lives in city hospitals, did suffer injuries from smoke inhalation. From the people who have died so far, also the majority of them from smoke inhalation were found in the apartment hallways and stairwells. One can imagine that it's because they were trying to escape, and unfortunately the smoke was too dense. I have heard that as well from tenants who managed to escape or were rescued by firefighters, that the smoke became too dense and they couldn't see. I spoke to an elderly man who actually passed out from smoke. Fortunately, he was okay when I spoke to him on Sunday at the gathering place for tenants. He tried to escape and it triggered an asthma attack. He passed out, but he was in good spirits and okay when I spoke to him on Sunday night. And of course, so the building does not have the fire escapes that you generally see like in brownstones or in like five-story buildings across New York that run on the outside of the building. Fire officials did say that there are interior stairwells for tenants to escape from in case of emergency. But, you know, the issue is that, you know, since the apartment that was on fire did not close properly as required by law, that allowed the smoke to spread quickly and create, as Amy said, this like chimney effect throughout that entire area of the building, all the way to the top floor, the 19th floor. And unfortunately, that caused a lot of the injury and death that we saw with this fire.
And what can you tell us about the owner, this Rick Roper, and how many buildings does he or his investment group own across the city? And has he made public statements as well?
So Camber Property Group, which is one of the co-owners of this building, and to keep in mind that there's a consortium of property managers and affordable housing providers that took ownership of this building about 2 years ago. This building also receives funding through the state Mitchell Lama housing program, which subsidizes affordable apartments, as well as Section 8 housing, which is, of course, the federal housing program. And so Camber Property Group is a affordable housing provider in the city. They own or manage well over 100 buildings in New York. They're also have contracts for the public private ownership or management program with NYCHA, New York City Public Housing, called the RAD program. They operate several public housing buildings in the Bronx and across the city through that program. And so Rick Gropper is the founder of Camber Property Group. He is also, as he mentioned, a part of Mayor Eric Adams' transitional team, advising him on housing. It is unclear, at least to this reporter, the extent of like how he advised the mayor on housing, whether the mayor is still liaising with him or you know, talking with him about that issue specifically. Obviously, they are in contact right now, responding to this fire. But it really does beg the question, especially when you hear the mayor in his public response speaking over and over again. You know, I've heard a ton of tenants say that they've been actually quite disappointed with the mayor's messaging, you know, speaking rightfully so about the importance of closing the door behind you and to be careful with the use of space heaters. But of course, many tenants feel, well, we wouldn't be using the space heaters if the building was warm enough. And, you know, the door didn't close properly as required by law. Well, the city agencies and the landlord should have made sure that the doors closed properly. So certainly, you know, a lot of frustration and anger from a lot of tenants and certainly even some housing advocates and frankly, New Yorkers who have been responding to and reading about this issue.
Claudia, in addition, some of the survivors were talking about how they didn't initially try to get out because so many times there were false alarms. They were used to these alarms going off on a regular basis. And that also takes us to Philadelphia, where 12 people died last Wednesday, including 9 children, in Philadelphia's deadliest fire in over a century, the blaze killing 3 adult sisters, 9 of their children, occurring in a row house owned by Philadelphia Housing Authority. Authorities now say 14 people were inside the building when the fire began, that none of the building's 4 smoke detectors went off when it started. Investigators believing the fire began when a 5-year-old accidentally lit a Christmas tree on fire. So this issue and the number of people now who lose their homes, what happens to them? Especially as you have this latest development yesterday, protesters blocking the steps of the New York State Capitol in Albany, demanding Governor Kathy Hochul extend the eviction moratorium, which expires, ironically, on Friday. That's January 15th. January 15th is Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. This is Tenants and Neighbors Executive Director Genesis Aquino. So the eviction moratorium ends on January 15th. The significance of this and what happens to these people?
Right. That's absolutely right. Certainly, housing issues and tenants' rights are front of mind for New Yorkers right now with both of these issues just happening at the same time. Well, as you said, there were activists yesterday at this Albany State Capitol, you know, sitting in and fighting for the Good Cause eviction bill, which would, you know, grant relief to some tenants when the eviction moratorium expires on the 15th. As far as the tenants in this Bronx building, you know, they are in for a very long, painful road ahead of them. Unfortunately, fires in New York are not at all uncommon, especially in communities like the Bronx. I have covered several other residential fires. From my experience, it has taken tenants up to a year to find stable permanent housing again, especially in the case of tenants like the ones at the Twin Parks building who have Section 8 vouchers and, of course, require placement in other Section 8 properties, which, as we know, are few and far between. As far as what's next in the short term for these tenants, their building owner, their landlord, is actually paying them to stay in hotels for the next 2 weeks. Several city agencies, housing advocates, and even some attorneys, some public defenders are helping them not only gather a case potentially against their landlord, but also helping them find housing and being placed in either Section 8 housing or any other affordable housing in the interim. Unfortunately, after the 2 weeks of them staying, the hotel expires those who do not have an apartment to stay in, whether by themselves or with their families, have been offered to stay in city homeless shelters, which, of course, has been very concerning for many of the tenants that I have spoken with. They're very scared of going to a homeless shelter with COVID cases on the rise across New York City. So again, they're in for a very long, fearful road ahead of them. For their part, Congressman Richie Torres, a Democrat who represents the neighborhood, said that he is going to do everything in his power to make sure that those residents who have Section 8 vouchers are located in similar Section 8 housing as quickly as possible, as well as other city lawmakers have made the same promise.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Also, the Bronx Tower owners have been hit with a $3 billion class action lawsuit over this fire that killed 17 people. Claudia Irizarry Aponte, I thank you so much for being with us. Reporter covering the Bronx for the New York-based outlet The City. We'll link to your stories. Next up, we look at the fight in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, to stop a new gas-fired power plant. Stay with us.
You cannot eat money, oh. You cannot eat money, no. When the last tree has fallen and the rivers are poisoned, you cannot eat money, no. One more time, come on. You cannot eat money, no. You cannot eat money, no. So the flowers can grow back again, just like the seed. Everything wants to live. We are burning.
That's immigrant activist and artist Yemi Gomez Castillo singing at November's march to the PVSC headquarters in Newark, New Jersey. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we end the show in New Jersey, where residents of the largely Black and Latinx community in the Ironbound section of Newark are calling on the governor to stop a plan to build a new gas-fired power plant that could worsen already poor local air quality.
Hey, Governor Murphy!
No PVSC power plant!
A key vote on a contract to build the new power plant is set for Thursday. Activists say approving the contract would go against vows New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy made when he signed one of the country's strongest environmental justice laws in 2020.
Residents in our environmental justice communities, who are predominantly people of color, have suffered from adverse health conditions at rates many times that of residents elsewhere, as the impacts of decades of prior health and economic disparities have been exacerbated. And we know that this virus has been particularly worse for those with underlying health conditions. So it is important to this moment that we send the message that no longer will economically disadvantaged areas of our state be dumping grounds, and no longer will the rights of residents to clean air and clean water be overlooked.
The power plant's backers say it's needed as a backup source of power for a massive nearby sewage treatment facility that leaks sewage during Superstorm Sandy in 2012 after losing power. But critics say the plant would run on fracked gas and its carbon emissions would actually contribute to stronger and more frequent extreme weather. For more, we go to Newark to speak with Maria Lopez Nunez, Deputy Director of Organizing and Advocacy at the Ironbound Community Corporation, also a member of the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maria. You pushed for this law that Governor Murphy is talking about. Explain what's at stake in this vote tomorrow.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. You know, and it wasn't just me that pushed for this law. It was communities across New Jersey who have been dumped on way before Murphy for decades by Republican and Democrats. Our communities have been used as sacrifice zones where, you know, just to step back here, in the Ironbound, we already have three power plants, three Superfund sites, fat rendering, you know, you name it, it's probably in our neighborhood. We have thousands of trucks that serve New York City and the greater metropolitan area that barrel through the neighborhood to deliver things, putting that diesel pollution into the air. So we've always known we need to look at the whole picture. It's why we push to have an environmental justice law that would give the Department of Environmental Protection the ability to deny permits based on this thing called cumulative impacts. And every time I explain it, it's so sad, right? Because the any government agency, they're not allowed to look around. They have to treat industry as individuals. You know, how much do you pollute? How much do you pollute? And never adding the equation. And I would say a fourth grader, you know, a four-year-old could stand on a street corner in Newark and look at the smokestacks and say, you shouldn't add one more. So what's at stake tomorrow is we pass this beautiful law. It's not yet effective. And we're having a fourth power plant that's being proposed. And so on Thursday, they're trying to vote to start the construction of this power plant.
And Maria, what is the agency that is going to be meeting, and what can people who want to oppose this action do?
Absolutely. The agency is going to be the Passaic Valley Sewage Treatment Commission, right? They actually serve New York City and 11 states. So this is beyond New Jersey. And we're asking Governor Murphy, actually, because we don't believe the commissioners will vote no. We think that Governor Murphy needs to use his moral authority, step in and be an example for the country that when you pass a law, you make sure that that's when the buck stops and that we start denying facilities from coming in, especially public utilities, from continuing to dump on Newark. So we're asking people to call Governor Murphy directly and say to protect law and to protect environmental justice. Because if we don't set a good precedent in New Jersey, what does that mean for the country and other states that are trying to pass similar laws? It really takes the wind out of your sails to see New Jersey fail like this.
And you mentioned the history, especially in Ironbound, of pollution. Could, for those viewers and listeners who are not aware, could you give us a quick summary of some of the historical problems that Ironbound has faced?
Absolutely. We are a 4-square-mile neighborhood, and we're home to 3 Superfund sites. During the Vietnam War, in the Ironbound, we had the largest production of Agent Orange, and it had a byproduct, dioxin, which is incredibly cancer-causing. That was being dumped into the river. The white powder from that went all over our neighborhood, polluting our pools. We've had pools, outdoor pools, that had to be closed down because some of my colleagues were swimming in dioxin, right? People who lived in this neighborhood. This was declared an emergency zone. We have this, the region's largest garbage incinerator. 50% of the trash for that garbage incinerator comes from New York City, and it burns over 1 million tons of trash a year. You know, we have 3 power plants. We have this sewage commission that's the largest in the state, and it's the 5th largest in the country. We have the Port of Newark, right, that serves all of New York City, the whole metropolitan region. 80% of the consumer goods come out of that port, and most of them get loaded onto trucks that barrel diesel pollution. And all of that, I'm just talking about my neighborhood. I'm not talking about the whole city. The city of Newark's also equally dumped upon. And so we're talking about decades of environmental racism affecting our community.
In fact, Maria, you have already the longest Superfund site in the country in that little area you're talking about of Ironbound. And talk about the community that lives there.
Absolutely. It's 17 miles of a polluted river, you know, and we've been fighting for decades to reestablish our relationship with the river. And our community's majority Black and Latinx, working class, immigrant community, that's deeply affected by the issues. And despite all of our socioeconomic issues, immigration issues, housing issues, we still fight to make sure that we're bettering our neighborhood. You know, we helped build a park along that river. We have a vision for our community. And that's all we're asking for. It's not anything extra. We're just asking for a chance to fight for clean air and clean water.
New Jersey already facing a threat from sea level rise, double the global average. And Amazon, is it true, is proposing an entire new terminal at Newark Airport that you're fighting?
Absolutely. We're fighting what we call a secret hub, right? Amazon didn't talk to the community and talk to our municipality about it. Port Authority, which is an authority shared with New York and New Jersey, had a vote that appeared halfway through the meeting to authorize this proposal from going through. Again, like our community, and this is why.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to come back to this. Maria Lopez Nunez with the Ironbound Community Corporation. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.